the week of July 3rd, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 110, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
115,432, 115,433, 115,000...
What are you counting?
Oh, I don't know if you know this, Michael, but everybody here in Los Angeles that works in the industry, we've all been enlisted by Paramount to count all of the money flowing into their accounting department after this past weekend, thanks to Transformers.
Well, you know, it's a dirty job, but someone has to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you should see all of the stacks of ones I have behind me.
Well, I'm one of those people you have to count because I saw the film in glorious IMAX 3D when I went to the suburbs for the July 4th weekend. Thanks, Brother Chris. And I was there, row three of an IMAX 3D film, which, you know, is my worst idea of how to see a movie. I was pummeled by the film. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, I think even if you saw it on an iPhone, you'd be pummeled by the film.
That's true.
Well, certainly on today's show, we will be talking about how the 4th of July weekend, it was the 4th of July here in the United States. We're going to be talking about...
It actually was the 4th of July all over the world.
Good point. Good point. You're right. But the actual Independence Day weekend box office was transformed into a 3D success story. Get it? Get it? Transformed?
Got it.
Okay. Just checking. We'll also try to figure out why anyone in their right mind would want to pay one red, white, and blue cent for MySpace. Do you see how I worked in?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. MoviePass tells us we can see all the movies we want in a month for the cool price of $50. Now, if only theater chains would go along with it. We'll be talking about the latest media and publishing news during Inside Baseball. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Right. So these figures are for the worldwide box office for the 3-day weekend. Obviously, in North America, we had July 4th on Monday. So there are a lot of numbers for the July 4-day holiday weekend. But that doesn't work overseas because a lot of people don't celebrate July 4th, of course. And numbers aren't available for Monday. So it's a little tricky.
Wouldn't it be easier if we just like made everybody celebrate July 4th throughout the world so that we could just do like a really clean box office?
You're right. That would be easier. So these numbers are for Friday through Monday, but then the total box office figures include every penny that we can, even for Monday figures, if available. So the number one movie around the world this weekend was Transformers 3 Dark Side of the Moon, which grossed $317 million worldwide from Friday to Sunday. And its worldwide total, as of today, as far as we know, is $399 million worldwide. That includes figures from its opening midnight on Tuesday through some figures from Monday.
But I think actually, Michael, you're wrong about that because I think it's actually Transformers 3 Dark of the Moon and that somehow you Pink Floyded it up.
Oh, I did Pink Floyded it up. I'm sorry about that. It's Dark of the Moon. I beg your pardon. So it's just under $400 million worldwide. If it set some good trends at the box office, it set the largest 4-day July 4th weekend gross ever, beating out Spider-Man 2. It also bumped back up some 3D popularity. About 60% of the ticket sales were for seeing the movie in 3D in North America. And those numbers went up even higher overseas, where I think the figures were 70%. So most of the people who saw the film wanted to see it in 3D. It also set a record, I think, for IMAX screens worldwide. It grossed more than $20 million on IMAX screens around the world. That's a record for them. So this was a successful, you know, new establishment of the Transformers franchise. Too bad they didn't actually make a good movie.
Well, I was going to say, you know, after Transformers 2, any movie is a good movie.
That's true. I read fanboy reviews where people said, it's not as bad as the second one, or I've seen worse movies. These were people who were like the geek core audience for the film, and that was the best they could say about it. It didn't suck as much as the second. That's really, you know, it's three movies in a row that have been just terrible. But
well,
anyway,
if there is a disturbing trend on this, besides the fact that the movie may not be any good, I can't say because I avoided it like the plague after seeing the second movie. But the unfortunate thing is that attendance is actually down for this particular opening. Now, one would assume that for a sequel, the attendance would actually taper off. So it's down 15% over the first Transformers, but it's way down over, say, Spider-Man 2, which, you know, it topped for the 4th of July weekend record, and even the second Transformers.
Well, you know, you can get caught up too much in slicing and dicing the figures. It used to be in the old days, and by that I mean the 80s, you would expect a sequel to make about a third less than the original, and it would cost more to make. Nowadays, people make movies and they expect sequels to make more money, or they expect it to make the same amount of money. And oftentimes it does. Look at the Harry Potter franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean, even Transformers. These movies are all going to make about the same or more as the previous one. So the idea that if the sequel doesn't make as much or more than the original or the sequel, that it's somehow, you know, falling off a cliff and what's going wrong here, you know, historically, that's just not the way it worked. No, so no, we're no, in a new world where you expect Transformers 3 to make as much as Transformers 2. In fact, on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the tracking was really low and people thought, wow, this is not keeping pace with how the second Transformers movie did. But word of mouth apparently was very strong among the fanboys. People actually liked this one. The second movie was absolutely – this one's bad. This one's very, very bad. The second one was offensive and bad. So actually, word of mouth is good. It's been doing better and better as word of mouth got around. So Friday to Saturday and Saturday to Sunday, the numbers were strong. And it kept closing and closing the gap between this movie's performance and the second Transformers movie. So in fact, long term, we're probably looking at a movie that will do better than that one, whether you look at ticket sales or box office gross or whatever.
Or attendance is really where I was headed there. And I would say...
ticket sales, yeah. Anyway, $400 million around the world. Within 5, 6, 7 days, an excellent opening for the movie. You know, we're arguing about whether it's a success or not, and it's going to be at like $800-900 million in the blink of an eye. The number two movie around the world is Cars 2, which grossed another $48 million worldwide. It's at $205 million so far. It has fallen harder in its second weekend than any other Pixar film in history. Not a good sign for a movie that got terrible reviews. At number three is Bad Teacher, which made another $21.8 million. It's at $91 million worldwide and counting. And number four is Kung Fu Panda 2, another $21.7 million. It's at $534 million worldwide and closing in on the $630 million that the original made. And number five, the big disappointment perhaps of the weekend, is Larry Crown, starring Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts. It made $16 to $18 million worldwide, mostly in the U.S. It made just a couple million dollars overseas, but it only cost $30 million to make. So it may not be the success you expect from Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts, but old people take time to come out to a movie. And since it didn't cost very much, this will ultimately be at least a commercial success for everyone involved.
Who are you calling old?
At number six, The Hangover 2 grossed another $12 million worldwide. It's at $549 million, almost $100 million over what the original made. And number seven is Super 8, the J.J. Abrams film, which grossed another $11 million worldwide. It's at $154 million total and counting. And number eight, Mr. Popper's Penguins, the Jim Carrey comedy, which grossed another $11 million. It's at $63 million worldwide, but still has a lot more business to do overseas. And number nine, the movie I've renamed Bridesmaids 1. Because, of course, there will be a Bridesmaids 2. It grossed another $10 million worldwide. It's at $188 million and counting. And number 10, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. It passed $1 billion worldwide with another $9 million in the booty. At number 11, basically a U.S.-only release, Monte Carlo, the Selena Gomez film, which grossed $8.7 million. And then at 12 and 13, Green Lantern and X-Men First Class. So, the weekend at the box office, Transformers 3, it clearly is the big news. Julie Roberts and Tom Hanks did not pull in the people. Kung Fu Panda is going to match the original. Cars 2 is a disappointment for Pixar.
Well, and Bridesmaids, I mean, I agree with you. I think there will be a – well, there will definitely be a sequel.
Will be a sequel.
Yeah, I mean, it has surpassed, knocked up as Judd Apatow's highest grossing film.
Well, there you go.
Well, and speaking of sequels, you know – what are two of the films, two of the would-be franchises that you would suspect may not have a sequel made of them that were released this year? If you could untangle that sentence and actually provide an answer.
Green Lantern, when its second weekend was coming up, the studio said, we're considering a sequel, because they wanted people to think, oh no, we're behind this film series, even though it opened so poorly. But in fact, it's sort of fallen off a cliff. It's not doing great worldwide. And I think the fact that they tried to say, yeah, you know, we're really thinking of doing a sequel, as opposed to, you know, signing somebody to write a script or spending some money on it, but sort of making noise. I think that was as timid a, you know, timid a claim as you could make. Yeah, you know, we really want to make a sequel. Well, of course you do. So I wouldn't bet any money necessarily on Green Lantern.
What about Thor 2?
Thor 2, well, that's at, what, about $400 million in worldwide, I think?
I have absolutely no idea. But yeah, it is somewhere around there because it did quite well, actually, overseas.
Yeah, Thor 2 did quite well overseas. It's a property that Marvel itself paid for. You know, they put all their money into it. I mean, it was distributed by Paramount, but Marvel did it. It made $439 million worldwide. It cost $150 million to make. So you triple your budget. That's a good sign. It should do pretty well on DVD. They might consider themselves lucky to have gotten away with it, or they may say, I think really they're going to consider this a setup for the Avengers film. And they're going to say, you know what, we're very happy. Let's see what happens with Avengers. If that's a big success, maybe they'll go ahead with another fourth film.
Well, now, Michael, I know you see all of these films, and I see as many of them as possible. I mean, it is really hard to see all of these movies that are coming out back to back. There's like 5-6 movies coming out every single weekend that are kind of must-sees if you're in our line of work.
That's true. But of course, the average person doesn't go to that many films, which is why I was intrigued by the idea of MoviePass.
Well, right. And I think that when I heard this at first, I thought, oh, darn it. Why didn't I think of that? Because effectively, it's taking the Netflix model of eat all you can eat for a single price. See as many movies as you can. Rent as many DVDs as you can, or stream as much movies as your bandwidth will allow in 1 month for a single price. But instead, they're saying go to the movie theater as many times as you'd like for the single price of $50 per month.
Right. It's a plan that they were trying to test launch in Kansas City. Details are still a little
sketchy.
Actually,
they were trying to test launch it in San Francisco. Kansas City is where AMC Theaters is located.
I know that's where they're located, but I thought they were trying to do it in Kansas City. They were trying to do it in San Francisco. I beg your pardon. So I'm a little iffy on some of the details. I mean, they obviously did not have any deal set with theater chains, because theater chains said, wait a second, we're not going to honor this. Even though the deal was, this company, MoviePass, would let you buy a free pass for $50, and however many movies you went to, they would pay the full price for your ticket. If you went to 20 movies, they would pay your full price for 20 movies. 10 movies, 5 movies, 8 movies, they didn't care. Whatever your $50 didn't cover, they would cover the full cost of those tickets. So they weren't getting any discount price from AMC or Lowe's or anybody else.
Which they couldn't really do, because AMC, Lowe's, well, Lowe's doesn't exist anymore, but AMC, Regal, any of these movie theater chains that participated, which none of them are, but they would have to pay the full price to the studio. So if they gave a pass.
Well, but they have matinee prices. They have discount prices. They have children's prices and senior prices and matinee prices. And I mean, I just called a theater chain to find out a movie price because I wanted to see what the prices were actually in Kansas City, not San Francisco. I went to the wrong town. But they had this dizzying display of options, like Friday before 4, Monday through Thursday before, you know,
it's
noon.
Like, it's like buying Saturday. An airline ticket at this point.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a range of prices from $6 to $15 for the one theater chain I happened to call, depending on what chain you went to, what time of day, and what screen you were in, because they have deluxe screens and IMAX and all that. So, I mean, they have all sorts of range of prices. So if they paid $6, they charge $6 for admission, then they could just, that's what they do.
Right. And they're going to make up the difference, at least MoviePass says, they're going to make up the difference by selling market research, you know, all right. The market data. Now, it's a company that was founded by a bunch of marketing executives formerly from, well, I was going to say the Weinstein Company, but it was Miramax during the Weinstein days, and people who are industry savvy. They're all former industry executives, and yet they didn't think to go and maybe ask AMC, Regal, Rave, any of these big theater chains to participate ahead of time.
It was very poorly launched, as even for this test marketing. I don't understand what they were doing, why they would announce it before they went to the chains and had a deal in place. But I also don't understand why the theater chains were upset. They weren't being asked to sell tickets at a discount. They were just saying, hey, we're going to give this pass, and whatever ticket they buy, we will give you the full price of admission for that ticket.
Well, AMC is a little upset, or not upset, but concerned that their own homegrown loyalty program would be usurped by MoviePass. So all of the information that AMC gets from having their own, I think it's called AMC Stubs. So that's their loyalty program. Go see 9 movies, you get the 10th one free, or you get a free popcorn or something like that. But what they're really doing is they're mining all of that information for marketing data. They want to know where you live, what your age and gender are, how much money you make, and that way they can tell who their customers are and they can better market to those customers. So they're concerned that that will overtake.
But that's not a huge factor for them. The vast majority of people do not use that program.
No, they don't.
I'm sure 95, 98% of AMC customers have never signed up for that. I certainly haven't.
If you think about it, you're looking at an industry, the exhibition industry, that is in fear of losing control. They feared it with premium pay-per-view or premium VOD when the studios.
No, that's got nothing to do with theater owners. I mean, that's the studio.
That's the studio, but they are losing control of the release window there. Here, they would be losing control of something else, and they just fear change. It is an industry that fears change and fears being out of control.
Explain to me why a theater chain would be worried about fans being encouraged to go to as many movies as they can at full price.
You see, that's what I don't understand. I do not understand what the issue is for
AMC,
for AMC or Regal. Why is it that these movie theater owners don't like this? Because unlike premium VOD, in which they were losing control of the window and nobody was coming to their theater, here they might be losing control of their own loyalty program, but people would be inside their theater.
But they could encourage people to swipe their loyalty card as well.
That's right.
So what? There's no. They could say, hey, we'll also give you this. We'll also give you, free pop, whatever.
Right. Or MoviePass could share all of that information with each theater chain.
Yeah. And theater chains can mine information from your credit card. They don't need their loyalty program because 98% of the people do not use that program. So that's really not a concern. But they're being told, we're going to try and get people to go to as many movies in a month as possible. And that means they buy more concessions, more popcorn, more soda. And they said, no, we don't want that.
I just don't understand it. I mean,
I also don't understand is who the hell would buy this thing. It's $50 a month.
Right. It's like, it's really the gym membership model. It's you pay $50 a month, you use it for the first 3 months, and you go see 8 movies a month. But then in the third or fourth or fifth month, you're really only seeing 2 movies, so you've really just paid $25 per movie.
Almost nobody, except movie critics, goes to more than 60 movies a year at the box office. And that's what you're talking about. You'd have to go to 5 movies a month at $10 a shot, maybe 7 if you're paying $8 in your town, depending what you think you're paying. But you'd have to go to at least 60 movies a year, I think, before you break even.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Almost nobody goes to 60 movies a year at the theater. What is it, less than 2% of the people who attend movies?
The average American sees about 4 movies a year.
Right, in the theater. Right. So people who go to a lot of movies a year, maybe they see 2 a month. That's 25. Maybe they see 3 a month. That's still not breaking even. They're looking at a tiny, tiny fraction of the audience that would actually want to spend $50 a month to go for this free pass, even if they only bought it in July and December and tried to gorge during the big holiday season. That's the only thing I could see somebody doing, saying, all right, it's November 28th. I'm going to buy this pass and go see as many movies as I can from Thanksgiving through Christmas.
But, it's a cross-subsidy model. It's, the person who buys it in July and sees 20 movies in July. Okay, they lose money on that person. But the person who had the subscription in July that went to see one movie or no movies is now paying for that.
But they're not going to buy it for $50.
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, how many people have gym memberships that they don't use?
Gym membership is something that they buy because they think it's going to be good for them and they want to believe they're going to do that. People don't want to say, gee, I want to believe I'm going to go to 7 movies a month just to break even on this deal. They got to go to 8 movies. They have to go to 2 movies a week just to start to make money on the price. What's the point?
Well, I think we've pretty much determined that launched this this company or this idea weren't really they didn't necessarily think it through.
It's strange because they did have a lot of money, a lot of smart backers. Had the people who want to buy MySpace, have they thought that through?
Speaking of things I do not understand, I do not understand why anyone at this point would want to pay any amount of money for MySpace.
Well, what happened to them this week?
Well, it was last week at this point. They have been sold again. Of course, they are the social website giant that was once a major player in the music industry and really in the internet space. They were huge. They were sold in 2005 to News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, for $580 million, a price at the time that, also included all of these other sites that MySpace controlled. I think IGN, I don't know if IGN was a part of it. But anyway, MySpace itself was valued at more than $320 million by analysts at that time. So there was a question of, was it a premium or was it a good price? But then in 2007, MySpace alone was valued at $12 billion. I mean, that's just a remarkable figure. Now, News Corp just unloaded MySpace to an online ad firm. What's it called? Specific Media. I mean, nobody's ever heard of this company. At least I haven't. And they sold it for $35 million, which is, by the way, also known as 0.3% of its value at the top of its value.
So the one little sort of starry notice connected to this was that Justin Timberlake has a stake in it. He's involved. He's been given, a piece of this new acquisition in exchange for his input and creativity. I'm not sure if he put any money up front, But he's going to be involved with them. They're going to be doing talent searches using MySpace. And they've got all sorts of ideas to turn MySpace into a music-focused site and say, you know what? We're not going to try to be all things to all people. We're going to focus on music. That's what they did best. That's what they're known for, if anything. And we're going to make it hot again.
You know, back in 2003, MySpace was kind of on the way up. And they were at Sundance. And I met with the founders and heads of MySpace. And they were asking me how they could get into the film business, how they could do for film and independent filmmaking what they did for music and bands. And they were trying to explain to me what MySpace was, and I didn't want to stop them and say, guys, I know what MySpace is. But it was a way for bands to go and have their own little website, little web page. And I don't say little in terms of belittling anybody, but they could have their own space on the internet to tell their fans where they were playing, how to buy tickets, where to buy merchandise. It was a way to do newsletters and
listen to some music and all that.
Yeah, and it was at a time when doing all of that online was really not necessarily easy. So that it was really great for the music world. For the film world, it never really clicked. And so by 2006, 2007, in my mind, I thought to myself, you know what? These guys should really be taking on iTunes. They should be all about music and just worry about music. Forget about all these teeny boppers that are making them go over 80 million users per month. Just worry about music, because that's where the actual revenue and money will come from. And they never did it. But it looks like Specific Media is actually going to do that.
But is it too late?
You know, MySpace, it at least has a name. So it's a name brand. But I think it's a name brand that's tarnished. And in the internet world, when a name brand gets tarnished, like a Pets.com or an eToys, it is really hard, if not impossible, to come back.
Well, you know, they certainly got at a bargain rate, I suppose. $35 million is, you know, a lot of money, but not a pittance compared to what it was valued at one point or what Rupert Murdoch paid for it. So this is definitely a bargain, I guess. I wonder why Justin Timberlake would want to be involved. It seems such an uncool thing at the moment.
Well, I guess maybe he got a few ideas by starring in The Social Network and thought, well, I want to be a part of A Social Network too.
Exactly. Well, and they're a classic example of a company that sort of missed the boat, tried to be all things to all people, lost its mission if it ever had a mission to start with, didn't change with the times, didn't adjust, and sort of floundered its opportunity because it was huge at one point. It was certainly a competitor to MySpace. I mean, to Facebook.
Well, absolutely. It was launched before Facebook. I mean, when Chris DeWolf and all those people were talking to me at Sundance, Facebook hadn't even launched yet. And yet now Facebook, of course, dwarfs MySpace. I don't even know by how many hundreds of millions, but by a lot.
And Facebook is in the music game too, aren't they?
I think so. Well, they're trying to get in the music game, and I think we'll see. I know they're having a press conference right now. I have a feeling that's to announce a Skype partnership, but Spotify is around the corner and they have a partnership with Facebook of some kind that has yet to be announced.
And didn't you highlight a story about musicians using sharing content on Facebook?
Oh my goodness, you're absolutely right. That's what you were referring to. So I don't know whether it was necessarily them sharing music per se, as much as them sharing any content whatsoever. And there is a company called Visibly, and it's a play on words. It's V-I-S-I-B-L-I. So instead of a Y, the last Y is an I. But they have this thing called an engagement bar, and not to get too technical, it's a link shortener. Let's just leave it at that. And they started taking all of this data that people were inputting through this engagement bar and found that the top artists on Facebook average 11.3 clicks per shared link versus an average of 4.3 clicks per shared link, which goes through Share This, so which is another way of sharing links. So
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Basically, when a Justin Bieber or a Lady Gaga puts a link on their Facebook page, their fans actually interact with it. They click. They're sitting there watching and waiting for the next link. It works, in other words.
That makes sense.
And so who do you think the top 10 artists are on Facebook?
I guess Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga.
So these are page views driven by top artists on Facebook in May of 2011.
And you're only including music artists in this list?
Yeah, I'm just going to include music artists.
Okay, Lady Gaga, Justin Bieber.
Bob Marley is third. Now,
I didn't know he was active on Facebook.
I'm a little shocked myself. Now, this is a distant third, so
his estate is putting stuff on Facebook to
right
have content.
Over 4.4 million page views were driven from Bob Marley's Facebook page, whereas Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber, it was like 27.7 million page views driven from Lady Gaga's Facebook fan page, and Justin Bieber had 27.9 million
page views. So that's an example of a smart estate keeping their artists present and popular, you know, developing a good website, developing a good Facebook page, and keeping them in people's minds.
Right. And so he was third, four, five, six, seven. Michael Jackson, speaking of estates, 3.295 million page views driven from his Facebook fan page. So those are page views on other websites other than Facebook, but that are linked to from a Facebook fan page.
Well, that makes sense. Celebrity, you know, if you follow a celebrity on Facebook, you care about what they say. So,
right, and I guess there's always this question of, is social media really worth it? Does social marketing really work? Well, I guess it does if you're a big celebrity. And I think, you know, the same thing is true with Justin Timberlake going to MySpace. Should we read what he said here?
Sure.
He says, there's a need for a place where fans can go to interact with their favorite entertainers, listen to music, watch videos, share and discover cool stuff, and just connect. MySpace has the potential to be that place. Art is inspired by people and vice versa, so there's a natural social component to entertainment. I'm excited to help revitalize MySpace by using its social media platform to bring artists and fans together in one community. And as somebody who often has to find an obscure band or music by an obscure band, it is really the place I turn to.
Yeah, anytime I see a band mentioned in Rolling Stone or somewhere else, if I want to hear their music, I immediately start with MySpace / their name.
Right, and it's usually there.
Yeah.
And they should have played that up, but...
So do you think Justin Timberlake's involvement with MySpace is a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's an interesting deal. Let's put it that way. We'll see whether it evolves into a big deal or whether it just peters out, kind of like Lady Gaga's involvement with Polaroid. Probably the most interesting music article I saw this week was one on NPR. It was a story about how much does it cost to make a hit song. Did you read this story or listen to it?
Listen to it?
Well, yeah, because it's a...
Oh, NPR. Oh, no, yeah, I read it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether the written story was a transcript of the radio story, but it's fascinating.
Well, I thought it was sort of dumb. I mean, it's got nothing to do with... There's no formula or one way that a song is created. I mean, this was an example of a record label taking people, putting them together in a writing camp, getting them into a nice studio for a couple weeks, hiring a songwriter and producer, trying to force create a song. Like in country music, it happens all the time. You know, country songwriters get together and say, hey, they map out a week or two to write some songs. You know, in this case, it's more of a high-powered, you know, top songwriters, top studio time to create basic tracks for a pop single. And, you know, NPR added it all up together and decided between the writing camp and the songwriter, the producer, the mix master and all that, and the rollout of the song, which, by the way, is, you know, counts 90% of the cost, you know, flying the artists around the country, courting radio programmers, and all that stuff, and marketing. They did, well, that little segment cost $1 million. So they decided to buy a hit song. It cost $1,078,000.
Right. Well, and the $78,000 part was the writing camp.
Right.
At $18,000 for that one song. The songwriter themselves got $15,000. The producer made $20,000. The vocal producer. Now, this is where I think, I mean, you and I both know that this is how the Rihannas of the world record their music. They have songwriters, they bring in numerous songwriters and write a whole bunch of songs, way more than they'll ever record. They then pitch them to the artist, and the artist says, I like number two and number five. Let's record those. A vocal producer comes in and then tells the artist how to sing the song, and then there's an engineer and a producer that mix and master it.
Well, again, this is not the formula for, and this is just a dumb article in my mind.
Well, it's not how Bob Dylan records a song, that's for sure.
95% of the budget is the $1 million they spend on marketing and a major artist going around the country to promote the album. Well, duh. That's a big label song. You can have a hit song by being the little girl who did Friday and getting it from your mom for your birthday and slapping a video on YouTube. So there's no formula. This is not how you make a hit song. This is not how it's done. This is how some people in a particular type of music can bring together people like, you know, top songwriters and studio people to try and create some good tracks that they might use on their album. And it's also silly to say that the vocal producer tells them how to sing the song. No, they give them ideas and advice and tips and all that sort of thing.
I think it depends on the artist, because I have actually talked to a couple of vocal producers who said they pretty much had to sing the song for their artist.
Well, everything depends on the artist, doesn't it? But I don't know why you think Rihanna is a puppet.
No, I'm not saying that. No, in no way.
You said it specifically.
Well, okay. If that was the way it was understood, that is not what I meant. What I found interesting here is that most people don't know this. And even though I think this formula may be flawed because the song rollout and all that marketing cost that you're talking about, I mean, you really, there's no way to pin a specific number for a specific song or even an artist, because you're courting, a record company is courting a radio station and radio programmers, not just for one album, but for numerous albums. So who do you expense that to?
Plus there's now, you know, official payola, you know, so you pay a third party marketing firm to pay money to record to radio stations to play your song. It's just legal now the way that they do it.
Right.
But the basic gist of the article here is the basic revelation is that sometimes when you have a big star like Rihanna or whoever, they sometimes pay top songwriters to get together for a week or two to work on tracks for them. Okay.
Yeah, they took
and they spend tens of thousands of dollars to do it. Well, I'd be surprised if they didn't.
Right. They took the song Man Down as their example. And apparently the writing camp wrote the lyrics to the song in about 12 minutes. I'm like, wow, are you guys hiring? Because I wouldn't mind, you know, 12-minute day. All right, here's your lyrics.
Right. And this person says that the writing camp for Rihanna's new album cost at least $200,000.
For the whole album, not just the one song.
There were about 40 people there. But you know what? An album can cost $1 million to create when you're talking about a top star like that easily. Getting some top songwriters together for a couple weeks to write songs for you, you know, it seems like money well spent to me.
So ultimately you're saying none of this is a big deal to you?
That's right. It wasn't any revelation to me.
Okay, well maybe some of the stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Maybe that those revelations will be a little bit more important to you.
Let's go.
Netflix stock hit a record high this week after the online and mail order DVD service announced it would bring its streaming video service to another 43 countries in, guess where? Latin America and the Caribbean by the end of the year. They'll offer U.S. shows, global and local TV, as well as movies to people's TVs, computers, and portable devices. Content can't be accessed in Spanish.
Can be.
Yeah, will be accessed in Spanish, Portuguese, and English. Think about it. Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean will all be included. Can Spain be far behind? And analysts still expect Netflix to launch in the UK. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. I think unlike MySpace and Blockbuster, Netflix has adapted very, very well to a changing market. Streaming is where it's at for them. They built their business on shipping DVDs to you, and now they are a streaming service, and they're making themselves a worldwide one. And it just shows a company that's very smart and proactive.
And so smart that rather than go to Europe, where that's kind of sexy, let's face it. You know, you got France and Germany and the UK. It's a sexy territory or a sexy continent. They decided, you know what, let's stick close to home. Let's go south to Latin America, where a majority of the people speak the same language. So the content will be similar in some regards. And there's two major territories there that are emerging economies, both Mexico and Brazil. I think it's a smart move all the way around, unlike going to Europe, where all of those markets are kind of fragmented and the rights are all fragmented. So here, the rights are usually kind of similar between, say, Argentina and Chile.
I agree. And it's the world is moving towards language rights, I think, rather than territory rights. You know, you'll get the Spanish language rights to something, not the Portugal and the Spain and the Mexican rights. You'll be getting language rights for, I think, all sorts of content, not just books.
Big casting news on the hit TV show Glee. Court Overstreet is out and Darren Criss is in. Overstreet will no longer be a regular cast member on the show, which means his new romance with Mercedes, played by Amber Riley, will soon sputter. Meanwhile, red-hot Darren Criss becomes a full cast member, along with the dancer Harry Shum Jr., who has been on the show from the start. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. They've added a bunch of new writers. They clearly lost interest in the Court Overstreet character. He was brought onto the show to be the big new hottie. They kept him shirtless for literally the first 6 or 7 episodes that he was on the show. It was kind of shameless. And then out of nowhere, this one episode appearance of Darren Criss became red hot. And that's where all their creativity and energy went. And Cord was literally sitting in the corner with nothing to do. So they clearly had lost interest in him. It's not a surprise to me. He's a fine actor. And I think he'll probably, you know, have more work elsewhere. But and I'm surprised about Harry Shum Jr. He's a terrific dancer. He's been on the show since the beginning. Thank God they finally made it official and said, okay, you're not just a regular guest star.
Right. Well, I think it had to do with Court Overstreet's lips. They were just too darn big.
Speak for yourself.
First, Starbucks drew customers to its coffee with some well-chosen CDs. Will Groupon be next? The Coupon Crazy website worked with musician David Gray to promote his new live album. It let all the visitors to its website know they could purchase his Lost and Found Live in Dublin album exclusively through Groupon for 1 week only for $6. It wasn't one of the Groupon deals where you had to wait until a certain number of people signed up for it, but it was a bargain right in line with the $5 digital albums Amazon has been offering. Gray does plan to release a physical version of the album later this year. According to Billboard, 3 days into the 5-day sale, the album had sold a whopping 1,200 copies, at least in the U.S. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop, ultimately. All sorts of places are going to be offering exclusive albums or music or things like this. I hate it when a DVD is only available at Target or an album is only available at Amazon or only at iTunes or only at Groupon. I just don't like it. I think it's bad for fans. I don't think you should have to try and track it down. Given how poorly this one did, it's as much a reflection on where David Gray is in his career than Groupon. They may do more, but I hope artists don't make it an exclusive thing. If they want to be another venue to get their music out, great. If they want to make it exclusive, I think it's bad.
And of course, Groupon is partnering up with Live Nation for Groupon Live so that they can sell tickets to shows that may not have sold out as well as, big hit shows, and they can kind of offer discounts at the last minute to those shows.
Right, and that's not exclusive. You can, you know when tickets go on sale for a concert, you can buy them at the venue or Ticketmaster or whatever it may be, and then if Groupon has a bargain, that's what they do. But being the exclusive provider of an album, I don't like it, whoever does it.
Right, I'm not a big fan of that whole exclusive album thing either. Do you hear me, Pearl Jam? Pearl Jam's last album, I finally figured out that it was only available at Target.
Ugh.
Okay, so the Haunted Mansion was a bust, and the Country Bear Jamboree has already been forgotten. But that's not stopping Disney. After the massive success of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, they probably plan to turn every single theme park ride they have into a movie. Jon Favreau is tackling a project that involves the theme park as a whole, plus 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is a huge priority for them. Up next, Matterhorn, the roller coaster of sorts that involves bobsleds, Switzerland, and not one, but two or three abominable snowmen. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's just inevitable. I guess the Hall of Presidents will be their next movie. I don't know how they'll do it, but they'll probably make that, animatronic thing become a movie as well. I'd never even heard of Matterhorn because I've never been to the LA version of Disney World. I've only been to the Orlando theme one. So I literally never heard of it.
Yeah, it is one of the bigger rides at Disneyland. Now, to give you some perspective, Disneyland in Anaheim, California was the first theme park Disney opened. The whole of Disneyland, its parking lots, the California Adventureland that they opened up recently or within the past 12 years, all of that can fit in the parking lot for the Magic Kingdom in Orlando. That's how small Disneyland is.
I didn't know that, but I'd still love to visit it. But, the Matterhorn, it could be a great movie, a terrible movie, who knows?
Yes. Well, anyway, I wish I could do a decent British accent because I would use it on this next story. After 43 years, Breakfast at Wimbledon will no longer be served on NBC. The network spent a record amount on the Olympics, but Disney turned around and outspent them to snag the full rights to the Wimbledon tennis tournament for the next 12 years. Fans have grown increasingly frustrated with NBC, which tape delays most matches and even cut into the men's semifinals in the fifth game this year, a no-no in sports, by the way. NBC did purchase the sports channel Versus and planned more live coverage starting in 2014, but Disney ABC outspent them now for the rights. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal to me because I want to see my tennis live, and that's what we'll get. We won't be delayed because of the Today Show. It's also a big deal because cable is supplanting network television. Two of the four Grand Slams will now be on cable only, the Australian Open and Wimbledon. It's probably only a matter of time before all four are on cable because they'll carry all the games live. And that's what you want. So what's the point of having it on NBC if you have to wait hours to watch it and it's taped late and they cut into the event or you already know what happened?
Yeah, well, think about it. We'll talk a little bit more about tape-delayed sports in just a moment. So I'm going to save my comments for then.
Okay.
Amazon is making waves overseas. It just purchased UK bookseller Book Depository International for an undisclosed amount. Amazon already has a presence overseas, accounting for 10 to 15% of its sales. But Book Depository is a strong name that delivers books in 100 countries within 48 hours of ordering and via free shipping. Ooh, I like that idea. Book Depository also boasts it puts rare and out-of-print books on sale via its Dodo publishing arm. The company says it will remain independent rather than be subsumed into Amazon. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop, ultimately. I think it's just a natural fit for Amazon. They don't seem to be, you know, just trying to get rid of a competitor. They want to keep it independent, I guess. We'll have to see how it plays out. Maybe they're either eliminating a competitor or buying a well-run company. So I imagine there'll be some backroom savings of money by, you know, combining their warehouses in some way.
Well, yeah, that's what they did with Woot.com and Zappos, the shoe online shoe sales.
Right. Yeah. So I think it makes sense.
Okay. Well, does this make sense? Crime does pay.
True.
True? Yeah, well, it does, at least for cable news channels. The trial of Florida mom Casey Anthony sent CNN's headline news to its highest rated month ever, even beating Fox News in the late afternoon periods of the 3 to 4 p.m. hours when trial coverage was at its peak. Seems like Oprah got out just in time. Nancy Grace has been eating it up with her trademarked outrage, ranking second at 8 p.m. just behind Bill O'Reilly, the number one show in all of cable news. But now what? Trial's over. You can't program scandalous murder trials with any regularity, unfortunately. Or fortunately, depending on the way you look at it. But are the ratings for headline news a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think they're a very big deal. It's summer. There's not a lot of network programming. I had not heard of this trial at all till I went to my brother's for the weekend for July 4th. And it was on their TV kind. I said, what is this? They're like, you don't know the Casey Anthony trial. They've been following it for a year.
Well, so, for 3 years. I mean, this is a three-year-old case.
Yeah, this is a huge, huge soap opera. It's, you know.
I'm outraged that she was found not guilty. I'm kidding. Well,
It's something that has always happened throughout history. Some scandalous trial, even if it's of a regular person, if it just captures the public's imagination, suddenly they're out there trying to grab the pamphlet in the 1800s or, you know, the penny scandal sheets in the 1900s, or they're going online to watch live trial coverage today. So it's nothing new. It's not the, you know, the greatest scandal in the world that something tawdry like this would create such attention, even though it's clearly not important news. It is entertaining news, obviously, you know, because of the ups and downs of the trial. But, you know, there's a reason why my New York Times and the LA Times did not have this story on the front page every day. It's just not important, but it does make good television.
Right. And I think that for the American public, at least, there is some wish, some longing that the justice system does work and that, you know, if you do something wrong, you will get caught, you will go to trial and you will be sent to prison. And
well, I think this is more about the appeal of a soap opera than it is an appeal for justice to be served.
Well, yeah, I think, yes, I would agree with that as well.
But, it was big news for headline news, and CNN is still trying to find its ground. They just canceled the Elliot Spitzer show, and they're moving Anderson Cooper up to 8 p.m. on the regular CNN channel. So he is the face of CNN, and I guess Nancy Grace is the face of CNN headline news.
Wait a second. You mean Anderson Cooper hasn't been the face of CNN until now?
I mean, well, it's now even more official than ever. He's because, you know, Larry King just retired. He was definitely the face of CNN for many years, I think, in many ways. And so now it's just, I think, as official as it gets. He's in at 8 p.m. He is the man at CNN.
You know what the problem is with books about elections? They usually come out after the election is over. Random House and Politico are teaming up to change all of that. They're planning a series of 3 or 4 e-books to be published during the 2012 presidential elections. Our audience, and this is a quote, our audience, their preference would certainly be not to wait until the end of the election, Jim Vanderhey, Politico's executive editor, told the New York Times. Continuing the quote, and we're going to test how viable this is. Politico and Random House hope they can pull together definitive, if somewhat incomplete, accounts of the campaign in real time. That's just what we need. Incomplete information to go and make our political voting decisions on. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It shows how ebooks have sort of released publishing into a whole new wave of possibilities. Just like artists used to put out singles and EPs and albums and live albums whenever they want, and now they're doing that again thanks to digital. We're going to see a lot more stuff like this, sort of extended essays and articles and short stories becoming viable again. Ebooks like this coming. I mean, it's almost more like a novella. They're expecting to be like 20,000 to 30,000 words in length. That's not a full novel. And clearly they're not taking the time to research and have a little perspective and, you know, sort of gather their thoughts. They're just churning it out in the middle of the heat of the moment. So this is, you know, it's not meant to be a record for the ages. It's meant to be a hot off the press take on what's going on.
Well, you know, we were just talking about Casey Anthony's trial being a soap opera. And speaking of soap operas, what a coincidence. Charlie Sheen is going to be roasted on Comedy Central September 10th, the very same night Ashton Kutcher makes his debut on Sheen's former sitcom, Two and a Half Men. Fans won't have to choose. Two and a Half Men debuts at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the roast starts at 10 p.m. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. Nope. Nice marketing angle, but not a very important.
I was really shocked. I turned on Comedy Central minutes after this was announced, and there was already, you know, a little bug in the corner about this Charlie Sheen roast. I thought, wow, they really are on it. Kevin Smith has decided to self-release his latest movie, Red State, as we've talked about previously. He, of course, purchased it at Sundance.
From himself.
From himself, yes, for I think $20 or a dollar or something like that. But with, you know, now he's going to have a little help from his friends. Smith garnered media attention by having a ballyhooed auction for the rights, as we just talked about, to his newest film at the film festival, but then keeping the rights himself. Now he's signed with Lionsgate to help on all the non-theatrical distribution. They've obtained the rights to the movie via packaged media, video on demand, sell-through, TV, DVD, you name it. The movie hits theaters in September. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Movie sells off DVD rights? Big whoop.
Yeah, I mean, I think he always said, I'm keeping theatrical, I'll need help with everything else, and there you go. The British government has signed off on the deal, so it looks like Rupert Murdoch's News Corp will be purchasing the rest of satellite TV company BSkyB, but wait, a phone hacking scandal keeps growing and growing and growing, with Murdoch's News of the World accused of hacking into the phone of a little girl who was missing and later found dead. Murdoch insists both that the actions would be deplorable and that his people are innocent, and promises to look into it himself, especially now that he has all that free time since he doesn't own MySpace. But with the scandal growing more sordid every day, this might actually delay the BSkyB deal for a few weeks and cost him even more money. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal that he's buying the rest of BSkyB. He's had a controlling interest for a while now. He owns like 39%. And so I think the general feeling of the government was, well, he controls it anyway, so who cares if he buys the rest? So the whole antitrust worry is, well, whatever, it's already over. This scandal has started with the royals and politicians and just keeps growing and getting dirtier and dirtier and uglier. His statements about it were so confusing. He said, this is outrageous charges. These are horrible charges. But I stand behind my people and they're all good and they did nothing like this. And yet, somebody did it.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. He just wants to be outraged because that's the smartest thing to do. And it will pass and the BSkyB deal will go through. And, you know, the collectivization of media into fewer and fewer hands continues apace.
Movies are making more money at the box office than ever before in history. But screenwriters aren't sharing in the glory. The movie box office set records in 2009 and had its second biggest year ever in 2010. But earnings for WGA screenwriters fell 10% that same year. Blame, fewer movies making more money, which means fewer screenwriters. Luckily, TV is looking better, and while new media earnings are still just a glimmer in the eye, totaling a minuscule $2.6 million last year, it is growing. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal that there are fewer opportunities for screenwriters in movies, but cable and pay cable and, you know, online. There's a whole new world where you can make money as a writer, and that's where the future is.
South Korea just won the bid for the 2018 Winter Games. The city of Pyeongchang will host the games, beating out Germany and France. NBC just won a massive bidding rights package that includes these games. There's a 13-hour time difference between this city and the Eastern time zone of the U.S. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's the Olympics. To me, it's always a big deal.
Yeah, I just can't believe that right after NBC spent billions of dollars, they said, let's make it really difficult for them to do this. Let's put it, you know, 18 hours ahead of the West Coast and 13 hours ahead of the East Coast.
Well, surely that's 16 hours.
No, I was hoping you wouldn't do that, but yes.
Well, I mean, is the 7 or 8 hours that Germany and France were the two other finalists, so is 7 or 8 hours that much better?
A little bit, because, you know, you can at least wake up and they're still playing.
Well, no, I think the 12, 13-hour one is a little better, you know, in a sense, right? You know, in New York, if I wake up at 7 in the morning, they're in prime time in Pyeongchang.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I don't know. There's no good way to do it. Everybody wants to see it live, of course. And then, but what do you do in prime time? Do you prepackage stuff and try to hope people don't look online to see who won what or what, you know, exciting drama happened that day? Or do you screen it all online and stream it constantly so anybody who wants to watch it can, and then, you know, package it together nicely in prime time for those who want to wait? You know, what do you do?
If I had the answer, I'd be running one of these companies, darn it. Well, and in other late breaking news, I'm getting an email here that DreamWorks Animation will be ditching their distribution deal with Paramount Pictures, I guess, after it ends next year. But
that's probably because Paramount just announced that they're going to be launching their own permanent animation division.
Right, exactly.
So they're like, well, never mind. We don't, you know, if you're suddenly a competitor, we don't want to be in business with you.
Well, then I'll skip right on to, and the new boss of the NBC sitcom The Office is James Spader. The network just announced he would be the new head honcho, taking over the role of Agitator, played by Kathy Bates. What?
He's not taking over her role. He's taking over the role of Agitator on the show. She was the head of a company that was overseeing Dunder Mifflin, and now he has taken over a company called Saber that is overseeing Dunder Mifflin.
But wasn't it Michael Scott leaving that was the big deal?
He's not playing the new head of the office there. He's playing the new boss that comes in and raises hell every once in a while.
Okay. Well, he is.
That's how I understand it. His character is Robert California. He's like a Jedi Knight, master of salesmanship, and he somehow made himself the new head of Saber, which owns Dunder Mifflin.
Well, he is an Emmy winner, you know, actor, and he does kind of bring a name to a show that just lost Steve Carell, who did play Michael Scott. But it's a modestly rated show, critically acclaimed, but it's NBC's best comedy. So, is it a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a good attempt to try and keep the show viable. I think they should have ended it with Carell leaving, but it's the only show of the sitcom of theirs that has sort of been growing. You know, the ratings for The Office were getting bigger and bigger every year, even though it's never been a very big hit show. And they're just desperate. How could they give up on it? They have nothing else in the sitcom or drama hopper. They're really in fourth place. It's desperate to see.
Well, I guess that does sound a little bit like some inside baseball information, don't you think?
Sure.
Well, okay, so then maybe we should move along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the news stories that only people in Hollywood or in the biz might care about. And this week, I'm going to turn it over to Michael because you have a lot of interesting news about media and book publishing. And so I'm going to let you give us a rundown of what some of this news is.
Well, the first thing is about newspapers.
I'm sorry, what's a newspaper? Just explain that to our listeners because they may not be up
and
on that.
Newspapers, of course, are still struggling. And this I found just incredibly telling. There was just a news story a few days ago about how top executives at the top 200 companies in America have given themselves like a 23% raise or some ridiculous increase in their salary from last year to this. And this ties right into that. The Gannett newspaper chain, which has had a string of big layoffs in the last 3 or 4 years, announced that it would be laying off another 700 people. Quote, while we have sought many ways to reduce costs, I regret to tell you that we will not be able to avoid layoffs, said newspaper division president Bob Dickey. It's their biggest round of layoffs for them since 2009. It's the fourth in the past 3 years. Oh, and by the way, this is what caught my eye. Despite the continued recession, despite their business struggling so much that they have to keep firing wave after wave of employees, Gannett also recently disclosed, because it has to by law, that the head of the company just doubled his salary. He was paid $9.4 million in 2010, which is twice what he got in 2009, and other top executives at Gannett also received massive pay increases. If anything encapsulates the problem with and top corporations in this country in general, it has to be that. It's enough to turn you into a pinko commie.
Well, right, because effectively what we're saying is that, you know, capitalism, these public companies where they ask the public for money to run their company, and then they return that money in the form of dividends and higher stock value, really these executives are just using it as a big piggy bank.
Yeah, and the board of directors' oversight of a company and the salaries of its top executives is absolutely broken.
I would tend to agree with you. And I guess all those people that they fired can go and join the people from MySpace, most of whom will be laid off after the sale.
That's right. So I just find it stunning that you can, in one breath, you know, fire hundreds of people and the other one say, by the way, I get a big raise. But anyway.
Well, and you have a whole bunch of news here from the publishing world. I mean, I don't know if we have time to go over all of it. So, I mean, you have something from Random House and...
Well, I mean, very simply, this is pretty quick. In April, publishing looks like it's plunging again. The sales are just not happening, thanks in part to borders collapsing and changing buying habits. Print plunged. Digital was up sharply, of course, though not enough to make up for the plunge in print, which sounds just like what happened to the music industry all over again. Overall, the sales in April declined 10% from the month before. For the first quarter, sales were down 4%. Among top 11 publishers, hardcover was down 22%. Trade paperbacks were down 25%, and mass market, which probably took the biggest hit from ebooks, was down 41%. So you're seeing what's happened in music happening again in the publishing world. But that hasn't stopped them from renovating and trying to accommodate. Random House launched an ebook version of a romance imprint that they had in the 80s called Love Swept. And it's called Love Stories You'll Never Forget by Authors You'll Always Remember. So they're taking titles they put out in mass market paperback in the 80s, gussying them up with a new cover, keeping the same name, keeping the same tagline, and putting them out as ebooks today, you know? So it's, you know, they see some opportunities. And here's what I really found interesting. Janet Ivanovich is one of the best-selling authors around right now, and I rarely see breakdowns of how books are selling in print versus digital. But her new book, Smokin' 17, came out, and I actually saw figures on how it sold. It said it sold, what was it, 200 and about 20,000 copies in its first week. And they broke it down. It sold 100,000 copies in hardcover, 100,000 copies in ebook, and 18,000 copies in audiobook. It's the biggest first day sale for a book in 2011 for Random House, and they're obviously the biggest publisher around. Her next book comes out in November 22nd, so she's, you know, a very prolific author. But it's
prolific,
interesting to see.
I mean, could she possibly be good if she's writing books that quickly?
Sure. You know, I mean, two books a year is not incredibly insane. There are romance authors who churn out 8 or 10 or 12 books a year. I'm not talking about her quality. I just think it's interesting that almost half her sales came in ebook only.
And now you say it's the biggest first day of sales. Is it first day or first week?
It's the biggest first week of sales. We're giving figures for the book, how it sold in the first week, but it was the first day sales were what set a record for Random House this year.
Right. Okay.
I don't know if it's the number one title for the first week. They just happened to mention that it was their biggest first day of sales so far in 2011 for Random House. But even now, with a big best-selling author, even though e-books and e-readers are not that widespread yet, you know, they're growing like wildfire, but a lot of people don't have them. Half of her books basically were sold as ebook only.
Well, you know, I read somewhere that Barnes & Noble sold more ebooks. I think it was in May or April. I can't remember which month. More ebooks than regular print books in their stores.
Barnes & Noble as opposed to Amazon?
Well, yeah, I read it, Barnes & Noble. I'll have to double check that because I was skimming something and I kind of caught that and I said, oh, I should bring that up on the show. And I brought it up and didn't have anything to back myself up. That was kind of
dumb. Amazon is much stronger, of course, in ebooks because of Kindle. Barnes & Noble, they have a strong ebook component. They have to, but that would be a really telling sign if they were starting to sell more ebooks than physical books. And that would probably be another sign that chain isn't going to be around for much longer anyway.
Okay, here from Time Magazine as well as 372 other sources. Barnes & Noble ebooks outsell print books 3-1.
Is that 3-1. Is that on their website or is that in their stores plus their website? What is that?
I'm just quickly skimming here. I have no idea. Overall sales at bn.com. So it is on their website.
Yes. So if you're purchasing a book at their website, you're more likely to buy an ebook. Well, that makes sense.
Yes. So in other obvious news, we can... Yeah, you're
now when Barnes & Noble overall, including their chain around the country, which is the number one in the, you know, in the US, when that starts to sell more ebooks than print books, even in their stores, that will really be a big day. And if you look at the Janet Ivanovich sales, it's not that far away.
Well, we had some pretty depressing news to end the show, you know, in that publishing and media and newspapers, they're kind of revenue wise, they're not doing as well as they used to. But we had some good news to open the show, which was, you know, Transformers making all that money. And this week we've been putting off listener email for a while. And we have one piece that we should read this week. And it comes from CJ Flynn of DCinemaTools.com. Should I read this, Michael?
Sure.
He writes, hi, Sperling and Michael. What a great podcast. And that he actually did write that. We didn't.
And that's how you get into our listener email segment.
No. I think that if you dig into the Sony deals with the big guys, now this is actually, I should preface this by saying, this is referring to our conversation with Ty Burr of the Boston Globe about the brightness of digital cinema and 3D screens.
Right. And in his article, he had a reference to the idea that theater chains made a deal or somehow got a bargain rate on their projecting systems. What was that?
That, I guess, Sony gave them a good deal or gave them some, gave them the projectors for in-kind services, advertising specifically.
Oh, that's right. They were giving them, the suggestion was that they gave them these digital projection units in exchange for putting Sony ads in their movie theater mix, which stunned you and you'd never heard anything about it. And this guy was going to provide more dish on that.
Right. He writes, I think that if you dig into the Sony deals with the big guys, you'll find at least one, maybe more, got a special deal because Sony wanted to get the exhibitors to drop one quasi-active lawsuit and several threats of suits for unfulfilled promises about SDDS. Now, I'm going to pause here for just a moment and say that SDDS was the 5.1 digital surround sound that Sony came up with in the 90s. And AMC installed it in all of their theaters, and then Sony decided not to support it anymore.
And so the argument here is that Sony said, if you just stop bellyaching about that, we'll give you a great rate on these new digital projection systems.
Right. Someone fully promised that they would keep the format available, SDDS, that is, which they are doing at great pains with new releases. But they stopped selling the equipment long ago, prompting the lawsuit. As an aside, he writes, I forget, but I seem to remember it was AMC, no Regal, no wait, AMC, maybe both. I don't know anyone who will talk about it, though. And he's right, nobody talks about it, and it was AMC. It is like getting the real information on a licensing agreement for a real D system. So he's saying that nobody is really going to talk about this. You know, he writes, maybe there is some deal for ads, but I bet that was a cover for dropping the SDDS suits. CJ Flynn, his website, dcinematools.com. It's interesting.
So CJ Flynn is clearly an insider making a joke about the real D system and licensing agreement, which nobody knows anything about. That's incredibly
yes.
opaque.
Well, it is somewhat, yeah. I mean, if you ask them, they'll say, oh, well, it varies per, per theater. It depends on what the deal is. And you can never get a straight answer out of them as to what their licensing agreement is.
So he's saying Sony gave a great deal for these units in exchange for, they said, all right, we screwed you with the SDDS by getting you to install it and then dropping the system and not supporting it properly. And we're going to make it up to you if you drop those lawsuits by getting you a great deal on our new system of digital projectors.
Correct. You know what a great deal is, by the way?
What?
Our podcast. It's free.
All right. Tell me more.
Well, it's free, and you can subscribe to it by going to showbizsandbox.com, and you can find links to iTunes, the Zune Marketplace. You can subscribe in your RSS reader. You know, you can also find links on showbizsandbox.com to all of the news stories we talked about in today's episode, as well as links to all of our past episodes, as well as ways to contact us. You can email us.
Just like CJ Flynn of dcinematools.com did.
Yes, I think we've now said the name of his website three or four times. So CJ and anybody else that would like to write us, apparently we will be plugging your websites. Our website, and CJ emailed into our website, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can call us and plug your website or other various items yourself by calling 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263, and you can leave us a voicemail. Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found, believe it or not, on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Of course, we have the Twitter and the Facebook. On Twitter, we're Showbiz Sandbox. And on Facebook, we're facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Until next week, play nice.